things related to friction. So it's an obvious term. Triboelectric means electricity related to friction.
It stands basically of triboelectric material separation, so that would be a separation of charges. I have an article in front of me which says it comes from the Greek word tribo, and the atoms of the material with, let me drop it.
By the way, the guy's name was Johann Carl Wickli, and it was done in 1757.
Amazing.
The atoms of the material with no static charge have equal number of positive protons in nucleus and negative electrons orbiting in nucleus. Material A and consists of atoms with equal number of protons and electrons. Material B consists of atoms with equal number of protons and electrons. So both materials are electrically neutral. And the triboelectric charge is a separation between the charges. Dr. Roy.
Okay, like everyone's been saying, it's basically based on friction. So that's what triboelectric. It's a nice long list. They don't seem to give orders of magnitude like electronegativity of different metals for batteries. They just kind of give you two lists of positive charges and negative charges.
Depending on how far apart on that list the two items are that you're bringing in contact with each other determines the amount of difference in charge you get. And usually we think we have to rub one item against the other. Not necessarily. In the case of a Van de Graaff generator, just the materials coming close to each other, or in some cases coming in contact and then breaking contact, one rolling past the other, will create a huge static charge. So the triboelectric material, that list, gives you a hint as to which one's going to be positive, which going to be negative, and as I said before, depending on how far apart your two items are on that list, determines how big a charge you're going to get when they're brought in contact. There's something about the electrons become more attracted to one material than the other. When they become in contact, some of them leap across the gap, so to speak, and leave you with a charge. On a winter day, you go scuffling across your wool rug and touch a doorknob, and you get a spark between your finger and that doorknob, and or depending on the materials that are on the seat of your car, when you rub your clothing against that seat as you climb into the car, you can get a static charge built up. And there are times when that can be dangerous, particularly if you've got explosive materials in the neighborhood. K2RIW listening.
K2KB with a comment.
Tribo comes from Greek, and it means rubbing. And by the way, there's a second element called adhesion, but that's...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What about that? What I'm asking is, would the charge of the streamer goes from the cloud down below, that is lower, has lower charge up, or would be from the upper cloud that is more charge down and takes you?
Depending on the polarities of the environment, the majority of lightning bolts go from cloud to ground, but a small percentage of them go from ground up, again, depending on polarity. It is whichever is the more negative element usually initiates that strike. Frank said he wanted to add something. KE2KB. Go ahead, Frank. K2RIW.
Yeah, this is KE2KB. I started a big argument between the physics department and the electronics department in my high school way back, because I insisted that electricity flows from negative to positive because electrons are the lighter of the two and they're the ones that do all the flowing. But then we came to an agreement. We said, okay, in a wire, in a conductor, it's the electrons that do the flowing. But in a material, like in a chemical material, like an electrolyte and a battery, they both flow. Like in a plasma, lightning causes plasma to form, and I guess you can get both positive and negative flow. Anyway, my question was, how can you tell the difference between cloud to cloud and cloud to ground lightning? This is KE2KB.
I guess they usually do it photographically, Frank. A hell of a lot of, a majority of the strikes are cloud to cloud. And cloud to ground usually represents a bigger gap. Now, air has a dielectric strength of very close to 30,000 volts per centimeter. You take two probes that are a centimeter apart, and you raise the voltage on those two probes until you get an arc, and it takes very close to 30,000 volts to jump 1 centimeter, which is around, I think it's 3 megavolts per meter, if I did the mathematics of that correctly. You know that the cloud might be, let me pick a number, 2 miles up, and you calculate how many volts must be on the cloud in order to initiate an air breakdown from air, from cloud to ground. And you, by various techniques, by way of a radio control model airplane, you can go, you can put instrumentation, you can fly a piece of instrumentation into the cloud and measure its amount of charge. How they do that, I'm not quite sure, but I know it has been done. Let me drop. When you do that, you'll find out that the cloud has nowhere near enough voltage at an air dielectric strength of 30,000 volts per centimeter or 3 million volts per meter. You have nowhere near enough voltage on that cloud to arc that gap. Therefore, you would say to yourself, hey, lightning, cloud to ground can never happen. But it does. You use the right kind of high-speed photography, you'll find that there's a whole bunch of little leader strikes that are roughly 120 feet long. In other words, the cloud has enough voltage to arc over the air for the first 120 feet, rough number. It does, with a very light discharge, go across that 120-volt gap, that leader, as it's called, and it sits there and waits for the next cosmic ray to come along. The cosmic ray does partial ionization of the air and creates the next 120-foot gap. This is one of the explanations for why, when the lightning strike finally does occur, you'll notice that it's got these crazy zigzags to it. It's almost never a straight line. It's because it took a whole bunch of little 120-foot, on average, length of leader, plus the next lightning bolt, the next cosmic ray coming along, to continue the process all the way to the ground. You take some good photography of lightning. Quite often you'll see this, I'm going to call it an upside-down tree. Let me drop. The tree has a whole bunch of branches leading toward the ground. And eventually, one of those branches bridges the whole gap all the way to ground of a whole bunch of these 120-foot-long leaders, and you get the discharge. And some of the branches of the tree die out, never made the whole path. Somebody wanted to add something to this? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet. There was a double there. Wes, I'm hearing. Who is the other person that's trying to get in?
A2, Jack.
Okay, I'm going to choose Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
If you ever look at a corona discharge around anything, you'll see the characteristic. But the key to this is that why some of the little fans die out as opposed to some of them that make the actual complete circuit. There's a certain amount of physics involved in terms of having that column of air ionized. And as time goes on, and they've done this with high-speed photography, that area of ionized air will dissipate. That's why some of the strikes don't happen where some of the leaders are. But because there's a time element involved in it, you wind up making all of those little leaders a column of ionized air, which makes for a wonderful discharge path. K2RIW, K2J.
Very good, Eric. I'm hearing a weak signal in the background, somebody trying to sign in. Who is that person? Give me a call letters right now, K2RIW.
A C2, SHO, Los Alamos.
KC2, SHO, in Los Alamos. I bet you you've seen some nice lightning out there. Tell us about it. And please repeat your name, because I'm so darn forgetful. KC2, SHO, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KC2SHO, this is John in Los Alamos. Good to hear you guys tonight. I've been listening to radio a lot lately. I haven't had a chance to really listen to the net in quite a few weeks. But anyway, here in Los Alamos, they do a lot of study of lightning. And if you do a quick Google search for 1663, 1663, that is the publication from the lab, In the latest installment, they are talking about exactly what you're talking about, Dick, and it's a fascinating article. Highly recommend it if the subject is of interest to you. I also have some comments on the grounding if we want to get back to that later, but that might be a bit in the wrong direction at the moment, so feel free to hit me again before the end of this whole conversation. Good stuff tonight, guys. KTLIW, KC2SHO.
Very fine, Sam. Sam, I'm assuming that you have scanned that 1663 publication of Los Alamos discussing lightning. Tell us anything about what you remembered when reading it as to what's creating the charge in the cloud in the first place, and what's creating the lightning and the difference between positive and negative charged clouds and so on. Tell us anything you remember from that publication, John.
If you think, I have a problem with your explanation with cosmic rays. It does much.
KC2SHO, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. I might not be the best person to recall everything from that article. But it was exactly like you say, is that it's almost a theory that the cosmic rays are... setting off this chain of events, if you will. And like you said, that the math doesn't add up. The charge really isn't there, so they're trying to figure out why. It's a several-page article. I probably read it last week. I wish I could recall more. Makes me want to read it again because now I feel embarrassed not to be able to tell you more about it. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
One of the main things that you have told us, though, which is a confirmation of something that I've been reading from a few other places, and that is that cosmic rays are heavily involved in the initiating events, the leaders that initiate the lightning strike that we see, whether it be cloud to ground or cloud to cloud. So it does sound like the ionization trails created by cosmic rays, and it'd be interesting to find out even if neutrinos are involved. I mean, you read any article about neutrinos, you find out a million of them per second are going through your thumbnail, and the majority of them do nothing. So there's a huge flux of neutrinos coming out of the sun, among other places. But I had the impression that lightning would never be anywhere near as productive as it is without cosmic rays. And there's a huge number of cosmic rays coming into the atmosphere at every instant of time. And so... they're a large factor in what's creating the leaders that initiate lightning. Is that pretty much what you remember from the article, John?
Can you respond?
KC2SHO, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Can I respond?
Dick, my recollection is that this was one of the theories, and there were some other things in there as well. But I'm going to disappoint you and not be able to state it so clearly. Again, I want to reread it now that now that you're bringing me on this. So it was a fascinating article. I read it around bedtime maybe a week ago. And you talking about it just reminded me of that article. But no, it was more of them saying it's a theory. It's one of the theories. What the other ones are, I cannot recall at the moment. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Will we be able to get that 1663 publication by just Googling Los Alamos? Is that open literature, or do we have to pay for that publication, John? Go ahead.
Open literature, paid for with your tax dollars, I suppose. Yeah, free to all. Paper copies are available throughout the lab. Also, it's available online for anyone with a browser. Good stuff.
Thank you, John.
GAS?
Thank you, too, GAS.
Wes, and then GAS, I think it is. Wes, go ahead.
Dick, how much energy is needed to ionize pop of 1 kilometer? True cosmic ray. Do you think that the energy is enough? I would love Dr. Roy to respond. Doesn't match. there is a manifestation of higher charge point versus lower charge point. Entry.
Many articles say that the cloud charge is never enough to bridge a gap like a kilometer in one step. Is that what you've also read, Roy? 82GS, KQIW?
This is all incredibly hypothetical and theoretical, unfortunately. I think we did a little talk on lightning a couple of months ago, and the mystery of it all is that it's still mostly a mystery. We have a bunch of different theories and good ideas and no proof whatsoever, and it's one of those great things that one of these days, hopefully, someone will get to the bottom of. I'm trying to make a quick alias to the article at alamos.ac2gs.com. I don't know how long it'll take to get the alias to propagate, but I'm going to put it on my link page so that people who don't want to do a Google search for some reason can find it this alternative way.
Question. Dr. Roy, you have a point of charge of 100 kilovolts, and you have another point of charge of 2 kilovolts. What would be the spatial manifestation of those two points?
It depends upon the distance, and it depends on the dielectric constant of the situation.
Good. Ionization. You have 100 kilovolts in one charge point in atmosphere, and then you have another point that has 2 kilovolts in charge with the same sign. And my question again, what is the manifestation between those two points? Dr. Roy.
Are you trying to hammer back again the fact that relative charges act like positive and negative? Because I thought we covered that aspect.
No, I'm talking about the manifestation. How do you know from equal distance from those two points? Let's say you have a second point of charge of 2 kilovolts and you want to know that this point exists. So you are at a distance of five centimeters, let's say, or let's say 1 meter. And then you have another point of charge in air that has 100 kilovolts on it. And then you would like to find out what is the distance between my probe and that point that I have equal level of my measurement between those two points, Dr. Roy.
You're asking at what distance between the two points you have an equilibrium because charge decays at 1 over r squared? I'm not quite sure what the question's about.
You are 5 centimeters from the point of charge that has 2 kilovolts on it, and your meter shows 2 milliamps. Oh, whatever, 2 millivolts. It's just your meter that shows, whatever the show is. How much from the charge of the other point, how much of the distance from the other point that has 100 kilovolts on it, you have to be, so your needle shows exactly the same. Enter XGN.
Again, I assume you do 1 over
N,
R squared. I don't have a calculator on me, so I can't do it, but that would be my guess.
Right, so when we're talking about the electric constant of the air, we're talking about point manifestation based on ionization. Because it does interact with whatever has lower level. So that ionization of the streamer comes from the point manifestation of its charge. And that what makes the streamer direct its charge to another point. Dr. Roy.
Wes, please stand by. You're covering up NY2H over and over again. Lou, NY2H, please try to get an edge in word-wise. Go right ahead, Lou.
All righty, this is NY2H. Let me know if you can hear me, over.
Lou, we're hearing you beautifully. Please proceed. We're sorry we kept covering you up. NY2H, KQLIW.
Okay, thank you, Dick. So we're on our way back from Dayton. We're on I-78, and there was a bad accident, and we've been sitting here probably for, I don't know, it was light out when it all started. So That's the story. It was very wet. I don't know if you've got any reports on the hand test invention. I am with W2NDR, Matt Harris. He says hello to you. So there you go. Back to you.
Very fine, Lou. Sounds like you had a wet time. Sometimes the weather out there at Dayton, or the Dayton area. I know it's a slightly different place these days. No, we have not had any Dayton reports. Yours is the first. So hello to Matt. And Lou, tell us anything about Dayton. Did it rain every day? Were there 25,000 people there? Did you buy a whole lot of stuff? Is your car filled up? And sorry you're running into a traffic problem. NY2H with a Dayton report. K2RIW, go ahead, Lou, take your time.
All right, very well, Dick. This was an interesting adventure. This is the first time I've been to the Greene County Fairgrounds, which is their new venue for the second year. From the first year goers, I hear it was a little bit better because they put a little bit of asphalt down in the inner track, the inside of a racetrack for the outdoor vendor area. Well, Matt and I camped out in his van, and the campgrounds there were really muddy and not... the facilities weren't the best, but, you know, we survived. It was an adventure. It spread out. There were lots of, there's about five different or six different indoor vendor buildings, like the five forum buildings, you know, and then, of course, you have the outdoor fest where Matt, you wanted to...
Yeah, tell him I cooked for you.
Oh, he cooked for me. He wants you to know that he cooked for me. He's a very established camper. He's got a history, and he's a natural at it. So we did have a good time, despite the, you know, the weather and everything. And I did pick up some goodies. Let me let it drop. All righty. I actually found an abandoned rotor, and what I mean by abandoned was it was in a box. With the, you know, controller and everything else. We saw it in front of a food vendor. 2 hours later, we saw it again. 4 hours later, we saw it again. And ultimately, it looked like it was going to be unclaimed, so I don't know what the story is behind that. I did a 13-element 2-meter Yagi, some connectors and such. Matt bought an audio, what would you call that?
A radio console.
A radio console for, you know, commercial radio. Nice looking unit. Back to net, NY2H.
I guess the real question is, with that adventure you went through and the goodies you were able to find, are you looking forward, are you guys looking forward to going back next year, Matt and Lou? And it's a little bit like when a woman gives birth. Right after she gives birth, she said, boy, I went through an awful lot of pain. I'm never going to do this again. And a year later, she's looking forward to the next child. So the opinion you give us now, when you're still in part of the adventure, versus next year, try to make a guess. You think you're going to go back next year, Lou and Matt, NY2H and company, I think it was W2NDR, K2LIW and the TechNet. You've got it, Lou.
All right. Well, Matt says he's undecided, so, you know, it's still a little raw with him. I would go back. It was a, you know, it wasn't bad, and I have to praise Matt. He's a dyed-in-the-wool camper, so he knows all the tricks, and it was really quite pleasant. We had a good time, and I think the club Dara, I think they're working on it. You know, we kind of filled them in on what we see as deficits, and they're apparently locked into a couple more years of contractual relationship with this fairgrounds, after which I heard there's another site in Dayton which is building up, so there might be some competition, who knows, because it's in Xenia, Ohio now, and they get quite a bit of revenue from it, so of course they'll try to accommodate. There are horses on the fairgrounds, and they run the horses on the track. One of the greatest issues we had was we were stuck in the campground. We couldn't leave and come back. So virtually we had no means of transportation if you want to go off-site and come back. You know, so that wasn't the most pleasant thing. Back to net.
So you had to park in one place and then go by bus to the actual campground, the actual Zinnia site where the flea market takes place. I'm guessing that the bus doesn't run very often. In other words, once every hour the bus runs, something like that. So if you want to go back to your car, you have to wait. And I think I heard them also say that there was a service they had where they would take your very large object and transport it back to the parking area for you, that you didn't have to hand carry it in the bus. So is that true? Were they able to carry that out? And how often did that bus run? For the last question, Lou, NY2H, coming back from Dayton, K2LIW in the TechNet.
So the campsite is on ground, so it's within walking distance of the vendor area, so that wasn't an issue. We did not need a bus for that. They do have bus service for remote parking areas, but the fact that we were camping was what made us be imprisoned. If you went on the campgrounds, they weren't letting you out until Sunday morning, or if you happened to get out in some fashion, they wouldn't let you back in. So we had to walk to the vending area. He had us set up in his spot, which basically we had to cover with tarps and everything, and, you know, leave some equipment there. They do have golf cart service, if you want to avail yourself of that. You know, and they try to accommodate, but we didn't have to deal with the buses. So I don't know what the bus schedules were. But, yeah, you could have come into town and parked in one of the remote areas, and then they had shuttles up and back. So that's the Dayton Hamvention report. And this week's TechNet, and we're still crying here. Unfortunately, I think there was a fatality up ahead, so there you go. This will be NY2H. Thank you, 73s.
Thank you, Lou. And my guess is when we talk to you next week when you're back on Long Island, we'll get some further details why they wouldn't allow your camper to drive back out. I guess they're trying to limit traffic. I guess the roads, I know that when I was at the Timonium flea market, the local road was nowhere near the right size for the number of people, so and it had a traffic light very close to the entrance, so that getting out was a very lengthy process from Timonium. And it sounds like they're trying to limit traffic, and that's why they wouldn't allow you to drive the camper back out until Sunday morning. Oh, well. When it comes to a slightly different subject, I'm going to discuss for a couple of minutes. Let me drop. From time to time, Roy and I hear people discussing the fact that the word infinity gives them a lot of trouble. We believe that we're on a planet called Earth, going around the sun. The sun is a third of the way, maybe, from downtown to the suburbs of our particular galaxy, the Milky Way. Milky Way has something like 400 billion stars. It's one of the numbers they're flashing these days, 400 billion. Four times 10 to the 11 stars in our Milky Way galaxy. And by way of the things like the Hubble Ultra Deep Field Photograph, they are confirming that there's at least 100 billion galaxies available. So 100 billion galaxies is 10 to the 11 power. 400 billion stars per our galaxy is 4 times 10 to the 11. That would suggest that 4 times 10 to the 22 is the total number of stars. Great, big number. 4 with 22 zeros after it, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. And we've had a brief discussion in the past of Auber's paradox. Because there's an infinite number of stars out there, almost, so therefore there should be a star in every single direction. No matter what direction you look in space, you should be looking into a star, and therefore the sky should be white. How come the sky is black? Well, it's because an awful lot of those stars are so darn far away, the amount of light you're getting is so little, that if you used very high sensitivity photography, you might come to the conclusion that the sky is gray. It's not black. It looks black to the human eye, but there's a little light coming from everywhere. But here's a crazy example of something that's very familiar with us. By the way, the fact that the space goes to infinity, solve this in people. In other words, we believe that you aimed your laser pointer in some direction in space. Those photons go forever, and if they happen to be in the right direction, if they don't hit another star or another planet, that there's no limit, that you could go in any direction in space forever and never run into a brick wall. And my way of looking at it is a star, space has to be going to infinity, because if there was no limit out there, the only way you could limit it, other than curving back on itself, and I'm having trouble with that one, is that there'd have to be a wall out there. And if there's a wall out there, it's just a matter of time before somebody goes out there and drills a hole in the wall and finds out what's beyond it. So we've got good reason to believe that space goes to infinity. Let me drop it. So here's a crazy puzzle that I'm going to pass in the beginning of this net, and maybe we'll give you the answer at the end. A very common thing that we know about is a deck of cards. And if I ordered all the cards in a deck of cards, put them all in order, aces first, all the twos, all the threes, all the fours, and I even order them as far as the suits are concerned. I make each suit diamond, heart, club, spade, in that order, if you know what I mean. So I've got my deck of cards all ordered in my particular way. And if I now take the last two cards, the king of clubs and the king of spades, and I reverse the two, I've now got another arrangement, another permutation. And if you now wanted to calculate all the possible permutations of that deck of cards, you know you're going to get a pretty big number. And if I had all the cards spread out on a table, I picked up number one, that's one card out of 52, and then I pick up card, the next card, it's one card out of 51, and the next card I pick up would be one card out of 50. So the total number of possible arrangements of those cards, the total number of permutations, is a mathematical function called, hell, of a sudden I can't think of the word, factorial. Factorial, that's the word. So, 52 factorial. Most of our calculators, modern-day calculators, will have a mathematical function called factorial. You plug in the number 52, and you hit the factorial key, which is usually represented as a symbol that is a exclamation point, and you come up with a great big number, 8, and a whole bunch of decimal places, times exponential 67. So, 8 with 67 zeros after it is the total number of possible arrangements of a deck of cards. All right, that's a big number. I'm now going to try to relate it to something.
Repeater, timeout.
I'm now going to try to relate it to something that is a little bit more understandable. How many grains of sand are there on planet Earth, inside of planet Earth? And in order to simplify it, I'm going to take all the rocks of planet Earth and grind them up into grains of sand. And I decided that my favorite grain of sand size is a thousandth of an inch. It's a cube, it's a thousandth of an inch on the side. 0.001 inches, which happens to be 0.00254 centimeters. And so I know the size of my favorite grain of sand, and if I go through the mathematics of that, I can figure out how many grains of sand I'm going to get per cubic centimeter, and it's 61 million grains of sand per cubic centimeter. And that turns out to be 61 exponential 12 grains of sand per cubic meter. And I can calculate how many cubic meters there are on planet Earth. So if I did that explanation, if I took all of the mass of the Earth and ground it down into grains of sand, a thousandth of an inch on a side, which number would be bigger, the grains of sand on the Earth or the number arrangements of a deck of cards? The answer might amaze you. Anybody got a quick guess on that one? I know you know how to calculate it. What's your gut feel? Which number is bigger, grains of sand of the Earth or arrangements of a deck of cards? K2RIW listening.
The deck of cards.
Who said that? What makes you think so?
K2NBB, this is Bob. I think I know that that the number of permutations of the deck of cards is probably, I think it's greater than the number of atoms estimated in the universe. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that's what it is.
K2M.
Okay, Bob gave us an answer, and somebody said KB2L. Give us your full call letters and your guess, sir. Go ahead.
Kilo
Bravo 2 Lima. Name is Ed. Yeah, the factorial function is one of the fastest growing mathematical functions there is. As I recall, and this is going way back to college, it's second only to n to the n in terms of how fast it grows. So 52 factorial is a phenomenally large number. And I would expect it would easily dwarf the number of grains of sand.
Yeah, both Bob and Ed, you guys are too smart. If I add the two jokers, so that now you've got 54 cards, and now you come up with a number of exponential 2.3 exponential 71, you're coming close to the total number of molecules in the whole darn universe. Ain't that amazing? And yes, the factorial function, a mathematical function, grows a lot faster than an exponential function. It's kind of an exponential squared. So the math of how many molecules in the universe and the math of how many ways you can arrange a deck of cards is really strange. Let me drop this. Once you know how random a deck of cards could be, so to speak, you'll know that if somebody arranged all the cards in order, like I described earlier, and then you try to shuffle them, you take half of the deck in your left hand, half the deck in your right hand, and now you fold them together, and you think you're doing shuffling. Every other card comes from left and right. You would still have all the odd cards would be the original order on the right side of your hand, and the left hand would be all the even cards in order. And so you'd have to do that a whole lot of times, and even then, it would still have all the high numbers on top and the low numbers down low, if you know what I mean. So doing a complete shuffling of cards, once you know how many permutations it's got, it's really a huge process. So it gives you a little bit of a feeling for infinity of space, how many molecules in the universe. So the deck of cards with the two jokers is very close to the total number of molecules in the whole darn universe. Really big numbers. At one time, they thought the total number of molecules in the universe was exponential 74. Now they say it could be as high as exponential 80, and they call it atoms of the universe. And you have a couple of atoms per molecule, if you know what I mean. So it's in that order. Really big numbers. Let me drop them. My Hewlett-Packard calculator will calculate numbers up to exponential 450. Okay? When it comes to calculating permutations, maybe you could use that number, but is it real? If the total number of atoms in the whole darn universe is only 1 with 80 zeros after it, and your calculator goes to 1 with 450 zeros, is that big enough? Without a doubt. Okay, I've had enough of this. Roy, it's time for Space Report. Here we go. Science and Physics Report, which will be number 30. And what subject would you like to discuss tonight? Roy usually got some good mind-blowing subjects. AC2GS, Dr. Roy, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
This is AC2GS, the bank. Just for bookkeeping purposes, once again, if anyone wants to bring up any topics or ask any questions via email, the email address, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And I'm going to be setting up an alias for that lightning article from Los Alamos. You'll be able to either type alamos.ac2gs.com in about an hour or two, or I will post it on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop. I just want to do a little errata from last week. I was so busy contemplating the mysteries of gravity that I kind of let drop other things that are emergent in gravity, if you will. And we were talking about this poor guy that I was exposing to a vacuum and repeatedly killing as a thought experiment. And unfortunately, I kind of got the concept mixed up, and it's really a basic concept of buoyancy. The guy really shouldn't be in a space suit. He should just be in a tank, and the scale shouldn't be outside of the tank. It should be inside the tank. And the whole basic concept is that although we are not really buoyant in air, there is a buoyant force acting upon us in air. So if you suck out the air, we'll all be a little bit heavier by about a tenth of a kilogram. In opposite, if we were to pump up the tank with sulfur hexafluoride, which is 10 times denser than room air, we would then be something like 1 kilo heavier. 1 kilo lighter, rather. 1 kilo lighter. So unfortunately, that was what I was trying to get at and running all over the place. So that's buoyancy. In addition, we were talking about gravity and where you'd be lighter and where you'd be heavier and why you'd be that. I have another little puzzle that has to do with a little complication, a little freckle on gravity. Is there any direction that you can travel where you would be way less than otherwise? Come on, any takers? North, south, east, west? Or you think that there's no direction you can go that's going to affect your weight?
Roy, if I went to the tallest mountain that's on the equator of the Earth, I think I would weigh a tiny bit less there than in other places on Earth. That's a guess on my part. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, Dick, you would. But rather than a location, I'm just talking about a direction. Is there any way that you could get into a car, a boat, a bus, what have you, and point it in any particular direction where you would weigh the slightest bit less than if you drove in another direction?
If you're going to the center of the Earth, CDF, I believe.
Then you'd burn to a crisp, and I've already killed that poor experimental person in the vacuum last week, so I don't want to do that. Now, this is just on the surface of the Earth. I'm giving you, say, a boat or a bus or a train, that you could direct the tracks in 360 degrees. Is there any difference between any direction, or is it all the same? And am I just wasting your time here?
Question in one whitey white.
Go ahead, Hank.
If you're moving east and you're moving at any relative speed that a car or train can go, can you actually look for relativistic effects? In other words, the faster you go, the less you weigh, or is it not enough of a theoretical to make that worthwhile?
Oh, I think that's really pushing relativistic mass and such things. That's not really what I'm getting at.
WH with a comment.
I might have doubled. WS to N.
Think VDH is first, and then you, Paul.
If you drove westward, wouldn't that oppose the slight centrifugal force of the Earth's rotation versus if you drove eastward? Go ahead.
Okay, we'll get to that in a moment. Paul, you wanted to say something?
You could drive up a mountain, but as you're driving, because you're actually accelerating to go up that mountain, you know, it's not going to change your weight, but when you stop and you get to the top of the mountain, then your weight would be different.
H-O-N-B-B.
Yes, Bob.
Yes, I think it's east. If you drive, like the other gentleman said, I was going to say also, you drive in the direction of the Earth's rotation, I believe that would be eastward, you would be going slightly faster and the I guess you call it centrifugal force, would make you slightly lighter.
Hey, you're all too smart for me. There's actually a name for this. There's a name for almost everything if you look hard enough. It's called the Eötvös effect, Eötvös. It has to do with centripetal forces, and sure enough, if you travel east, you increase the forces expelling you off the Earth, opposing gravity. You weigh slightly less. If you travel west, you slow down that effect and you weigh a little bit more. So it's that, and it's also the fatness in the equator that give you that odd change in weight. So, you know, weight is an interesting thing that we often get confused with. They're two separate things, and they can get very confusing, especially when you start to talk about buoyancy here. What's the Erebus effect? I don't know if anyone has been listening to the news, the internet. I like optical illusions, but you really can't do much in the way of optical illusions on the radio. But there are acoustic illusions, and there's one that's all over the place on the internet, even in the White House. There's a sound which people interpret as one of two things, almost 50-50. One group hears something 43%, and the other 57% hear something slightly different. So I'd like to play it for the audience and get their opinions of what the heck I've just played.
Laurel. Laurel. Laurel.
Okay, anyone want to volunteer what that said?
I heard Laurel, BDH. I concur, WS2N.
I heard Laurel also, KD2NDB.
Did anyone hear Yanny? Once again, did anyone hear anything other than...
idea of what's going on. I wasn't sure what was going on when I saw this to be KC2SHO. Please continue.
Okay, getting back, did anyone hear anything but Laurel? Was it 100% Laurel listeners?
Laurel, K2QR.
Laurel, KC2SHO.
KD2OQC with a question.
What's your question?
This bullshit.
John, you had a question?
Howling this bullshit.
Okay, personally, it sounds like Yanny to me. Now, maybe it's an aspect of going through the repeater, I don't know. I thought that the FM would have enough frequency range where the sound would translate. But usually, if you go to the internet, about 43% of people, like myself, hear Yanny, and the other 50% hear Laurel. So it's a degree of audio ambiguity that your brain kind of pieces together and tries to make sense of. So it sounds different to different people. So I'm a little bit confused that there's no one else other than me who can hear Yanny from that, but maybe it's an aspect. The repeater's frequency range.
VDH with a comment?
Why, it's not working for you.
VDH first, and the second person knows why it's not working for me.
How? PTZ.
That was KB2L with a guess as to why it's not working the way you had hoped.
PTZ. How?
I found a site on the net where they let you vary the frequency response of it. You can push it to one side and it gives you a very high frequency response. On the other side, it gives you a very low frequency response. And I found that one way you would hear Yanny, the other way you would hear Laurel. After I got used to it for a while, I was able to will by leaving it in the center. Will myself either to hear Yanny or Laurel. So there is something very interesting going on. Go ahead.
Oh, PTZ.
PGT? PGD? I can't quite make out what your suffix is.
Ow.
PGD, you wanted to say something?
He
anyway, the Yanni is apparently at a higher frequency. It adds noise that causes some people who favor their high-frequency registers to hear Yanni, and the others hear Laurel. So that's the long and the short of it. They're even discussing it in the White House. I just would amuse some people. I have a second acoustic illusion that hopefully will sound a little bit better. We'll give it a try and see if it works.
A quick question, Roy. Have you ever had your hearing tested? And do you hear beyond 4KC, beyond 8KC, beyond 14KC? Do you happen to know where the upper end of your hearing is, Roy? Go ahead.
Falls off after 10K.
That's quite good. You'd be amazed how many people fall off after about 5K.
You know, it's age-related, so maybe that's a factor. I don't know. I mean, I didn't think my hearing was that terribly good. It's a shame that, you know, there's no real good way of me testing this on repeaters. I tried this on single sideband earlier today, but it only with 3KC of a bandwidth, it didn't really work.
No, you could send me a file. I can play it directly out of the machine.
Okay, I'll send one to you.
Okay. Do you know where to send it?
Yes, I think I have your email someplace. Next time I get a little pause, I will send it to you. Let me try this new file and see if this works out for anyone.
I found the other one on the internet. It still sounds like Laurel WS2N.
That could be the audio bandpass of your equipment that's playing it, though, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay, well, Roy came out on the ham rig, and the audio came out on the computer, so it's different, you know, we're comparing it, you know, apples to oranges.
Yeah, I don't know exactly who selects out the 43% that hear Yanni and the 57% that hear Laurel. I don't know if it has to do with the FM bandwidth. You know, like I said before, I'll send Eric a copy of the audio file and maybe see if that makes any difference. But I have another file that's a little less complicated, and hopefully it'll amuse someone.
KE2KB with a comment.
KB, please give us your comment.
This is KE2KB. I found a website where you can change the frequency response of what's playing, and it changes to Yanni as you go up in frequency, as you drop the lower frequencies and hear and accentuate the higher. The website is https://nytimes.com/interactive/2018/05/16/upshot/audio-clip.
Shortener, and just type in Laurel, that's L-A-U-R-E-L dot AC2GS dot com, and it'll take you directly there.
KE2HUC with the question.
HUC.
Roy, when you were playing this for us, what were you playing on? Is that your cell phone or your computer?
It's my computer feeding into my Flex SDR.
This is an interesting experiment that I saw some people talking about online. Try listening to it on a cell phone, but not when the cell phone is connected to a Wi-Fi signal, when it's got the reduced bandwidth of a cell site. Some people have been saying that depending upon the bandwidth, it changes the way it sounds, I guess due to compression. KD2HUC, back to net.
I agree. It's very sensitive to equalization and bandwidth, and so that might be what's going on with the FM signal tonight. But unless anyone has any other further comments about good old Yanni and Laurel. And once again, all you got to do is type laurel.ac2gs.com and it'll bring up the New York Times page that was mentioned earlier. If anyone doesn't have any other further questions, I'll move on to the second acoustic illusion.
VDH, just with one more comment.
Sure, VDH.
Yeah, I went to that New York Times website where you can vary the bandwidth, and it does make a change from Laurel to Yanny. Something interesting happened, though. After listening to it for a while, I was able to, just by leaving it in the middle and forcing myself to hear either Laurel or Yanny, either alternating, just by sheer force of will. So there's a little more stuff going on there than I think just bandwidth. Go ahead.
Well, there are a lot of strange acoustic illusions that use ambiguity. Some of them are easier in your mind to kind of decide what you're going to hear. A lot of times people will play nonsense audio and then will give you a quote that it sort of sounds like. And once you have that in your mind, you hear that quote coming from that strange noise. So you put it together. And there are some that are just ambivalent enough that it could go one or the other. The Yanny and the Laurel is sort of difficult, to my understanding, of people to kind of switch on and off. If you tweak the settings so that the higher end is different than it's designed to be, then it probably puts you in that 50-50 transition where your mind can make the difference. There's also wonderful acoustic illusion that requires video, where people are saying something that sounds something between a B and a V. And if you watch their lips, if they're making a B motion with their lips, you hear B. And if you see them do a V, you hear V, even though it's the same audio file playing for both.
Sort of like a coupling between your visual and the audio. Yeah, that's very interesting.
I mean, these are all ways that the human body kind of cut corners, because there's limitations to everything, and everything, even biologically, is a compromise. So evolutionary tricks have been developed that work most of the time. And if you're clever enough, you can figure out ways around it and trick the system. And that's what optical illusions are, acoustic illusions are. Anyway, let me play a tone, and I'd like people to explain to me what they hear. Do they hear something go up and down? Do they hear something stay the same? Just kind of tell me where the pitch is going.
But the lower one is kind of going down relative to the upper one.
So you're saying that for all intents and purposes, the pitch just keeps on going up. Is that what you're saying? I mean, there's something else going on that you noticed, but the pitch just keeps going up.
One YDY, my guess is that you're hearing the same set of pitch going from low to high and then repeating, but at an ever greater volume.
Being tricked by this illusion, but it's sort of being out, like getting farther from the upper one. So it's not going up as much, or it's going down, I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, I think the filter response is what is shifting. There is an overall bandpass filter response that is constantly moving. I don't think either one of the tones are moving. Go ahead.
In one way, do I?
Some people think that it's moving up. Some people... it's moving up and staying the same, some that it's not moving at all. Anyone else? Confirmation.
N1YDY, I think that it's repeating, that you continue to have a low to high, but an increasing volume.
Started at a volume and just increased the volume across the entire range.
But there's a repeating cyclical sound. It goes from low tone to high tone and then repeats low tone to high tone while it's increasing volume.
description. Anyone else have any way of describing what that might have been?
I think I now agree with the last person.
It's close to what's going on. Anyone else have any other opinion, dears, and what have you?
Still on?
Yes, Paul.
It sounded like one started off low and just kept going higher and higher, and then there was one in the background that kept repeating, starting off low and then, you know, climbing higher in frequency over and over again. But there was one main one that just